Hey, 99 Pages, I want you to imagine something for a second. I want you to imagine getting back a performance review from your manager telling you, you come off as young and enthusiastic, you should seek to have more gravitas. What does gravitas even mean? Well, as a young Asian American woman at McKinsey, this is exactly what happened to Lisa Sun. Now, Lisa went on to have a very successful career, both at McKinsey and as a fashion entrepreneur, but that question of what is gravitas has been coalescing in her mind. And she finally put it down on paper in a fascinating new book trying to redefine how we talk about confidence in the workplace. My conversation with Lisa was one of the most fun and uplifting I've had on the show in some time. She brings the rigor of a professional researcher with the savvy of a seasoned entrepreneur. I think you'll enjoy the conversation. And if you do, please consider signing up for our mailing list at 99pages.club. We send just 2 emails a month, one to promote our recent episode and a second sharing some great nonfiction reviews that we think are worthy of your reading list. Thanks and enjoy the conversation.
At a surface level, it feels like the concept of confidence has been addressed in, you know, a variety of other books, you know, and I think a lot of readers are familiar with things like Lean In, Presence, Brené Brown's kind of library, if you will. You know, you wrote this book, Gravitas, and I would love to hear from you. What were you hoping to add to the conversation about confidence in the workplace?
Yes. So, you know, our book wouldn't exist without those books coming before us. I always say that the books like Lean In, Presence, Brené Brown's work open doors, and we're really a continuation of the work. I have such admiration for what they've done, but they've opened a conversation. I think of our book as being an important paradigm shift around the idea of confidence, as well as a very practical playbook on how to embody a whole new approach to it. So I'll give you an example. One of the most important things that we talk about is confidence is a choice and a mindset that leads to a behavior. So many books about confidence focus on behaviors. And what we've realized is if you look up the word confidence in the dictionary, it has nothing to do with performance, bravado, or swagger. It's an understanding and appreciation of your own abilities. Something which as adults, you know, any five-year-old, if you ask them what they're the best at in the world, they'll tell you right away. And what we've done in our book, we've identified the forces that hold us back from confidence. They usually appear around adolescence between the ages of 8 and 12. And as an adult, in order for you not to be faking it, you have to really be able to take inventory of your strengths and your abilities before it becomes an expression that you get credit for. So I think we're a continuation of these imperatives to really take ownership of our lives, stand in our own power, be the strongest versions of ourselves. But we're double clicking on the idea of how do we really drive self-esteem and what is a new vocabulary for us to think about self-esteem.
I love your delivery and I love your passion for it. One thing, even just as a reader of these books and a working professional myself, like it's refreshing to have someone not only who's from industry, but also, let's be honest, who is a salesperson, right? Actually talking about this stuff because, you know, I love Amy Cuddy, love Brené Brown, love, I love the academics who have talked a lot about this stuff, but it's so refreshing actually to hear someone from industry who's like an entrepreneur, like out there hustling. You know what I mean? You're hustling out there trying to sell.
I thank you for saying that because I actually have gotten that criticism too of like what gives you the right. And I always say, look, I grew up with immigrant parents. So if you talk about growing up with nothing and creating something from nothing, been there, done that. I spent 11 years at McKinsey & Company, and so I have corporate experience, right? I have the real corporate chops of being in the boardroom, oftentimes the only woman of color in the boardroom with major CEOs, but 11 years of being a consultant, and then 10 years running my own fashion business. So I always say whether it's the boardroom or the dressing room, I have lived experience. And on top of it, in our book, we did a 1,000-person quantitative study and 32 focus groups led by my old boss from McKinsey. I coaxed her out of retirement, the former head of Global Consumer Insights. And so while I'm not an academic, I brought that rigor to to the process. So think of this book as a combination of my own insights, but also really in-depth research that was primary, proprietary, quantitative, and qualitative. And I'm out there doing it, right? I dress thousands of women a year. I stand on stages. I get to hear really deeply personal stories. There is not a LinkedIn message that I don't respond to. So when people ask me a question or they want to share a life story, those are all things that get inputted into our body of work.
That's fantastic.
Thank you for acknowledging that. Thank you for acknowledging that. That's awesome.
Absolutely.
You got it.
I mean, because look, I, you know, anyone who's an avid reader of these, like, I don't know what to call it, professional self-help, whatever, you know,
yeah.
Like, I'm very highly attuned to a voice who, has spent their entire career in a classroom. And it's, in many ways, it's almost like, who do you think you are? Right? Like, don't reduce me down to a study. Like, I'm complex. The way I describe, you know, like I came up in the world of sales, you know, when you go into a room and your job is to perpetually get rejected, right? And especially as an entrepreneur, right? Like, you're starting your company, you have been told no so many freaking times, you know, because I've been there before. And it's not like you're just analyzing it abstractly from the sidelines. You've been in there, and Lord knows you're an entrepreneur, you're a salesperson, you're out there putting yourself in these positions to be told no constantly. Your confidence has to be taken a shellacking. Before we dive into the meat of the book, I really would love for you to share the origin story of the name of the book, Gravitas. I think it was so cool how it came to be. Would you mind sharing that?
Yeah. So when I started at McKinsey & Company, I was a first year business analyst. And in my first professional review, the opening line was, Lisa comes across as young and overly enthusiastic at times. She should seek to have more gravitas. Do you know what the word gravitas means, by the way?
I read that line. She needs to have more gravitas. I couldn't decide if it was more sexist or racist. And I mean that very seriously, because on one hand, like, Asian culture has been infantilized by Western media and Western elites. I've seen it, I've done it, and I've been through that as well. But also, like, I don't think a man ever gets told to have more gravitas. And I was like, is this more sexist or racist? But yeah, if I saw that on my performance review, I'd have been like, well, what are you supposed to do with that?
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's actually the starting point for the creation of my company, right? And the thoughts around this book. And what you've highlighted is, it's a very complex question, right? So when you're told to have more gravitas, to have more confidence, there's actually three different things happening simultaneously that we can kind of deconstruct. One is, there for sure is systemic bias, right? There for sure are ways in which, if, for example, you're like me, you're a woman of color, you don't fit a prototype of leadership that they've seen before. And so certainly, I don't want to call out this person as sexist or classist or anything, because they are a supporter of me and they're an investor in my company now. But what I think is important to recognize is the ways in which power structures are developed. They can be asymmetrical, right? They cannot be to the benefit of new types of profiles of leadership. I think the second thing, though, is if you double click on what she was really trying to tell me, it was really about, how do you see yourself before other people do? Because when I asked her, how do you get gravitas? It really was about, you know, put on a great dress, look in the mirror, and love yourself. I'll teach you how to be good at this job, but I can't teach you how to like yourself. And so the inspiration for my fashion company was, Dumbo did not need a feather to fly, but it reminded him that he could. And so we are a reminder to catalyze confidence in your life. So I do love that portion of feedback. And then the third thing, though, which I think is very hard for a 22-year-old, and why I wrote this book, I think you write the book you most need to read yourself, is at every stage of my career, when I've had tough feedback or a transition, I've really spiraled. I've really taken it personally. And I was like, you know, I need to write a book where I can help myself take an inventory of my strengths so that I can receive feedback like that. So it doesn't feel like a stick of dynamite, that it feels like a gift. Because I still value myself.
That is quite brilliant. You write the book you need to read yourself. That is very brilliant, very wise. And I'm gonna have to take that one away for sure. And you know, I think anyone who considers a career of 40 years or whatever, like, you're probably going to work for several companies, and those points of transition are inevitably going to come. And sometimes they're voluntary, and many times they're not. And in either case, taking inventory of what you actually bring to the table, I think, is vital. So let's dive in. So you highlight 8 superpower strengths that we're going to use to redefine confidence in the workplace. And look, there were some that I found quite intuitive, like performing, achieving, knowing even. I thought it was like, got it. But then there were a handful of these that I was like, I'm not sure if I'm getting that. And the one that I wanted to highlight and have you explain to me is believing. What exactly is this superpower?
Oh, yeah.
It seems like there's a lot under the surface here. And what are we going to learn from?
By the way, I think you can use my line and say you host the podcast you most need to listen to yourself, right? Like the one that you most want to hear yourself. So use that. My podcast is basically what I would want to listen to and learn from. Before I get to believing, I do want to say, like, look, the quantitative research unveiled these 8 types of confidence. Most of us have 2 or 3. My mom took the quiz at myconfidencelanguage.com. She has all 8. It's like, I'm all of these. By the way, 2% of our data set has all 8. The 2 most classic ones that you highlighted are leading and performing, right? I'm in charge. I'm extroverted. I'm charismatic. Those are what most confidence books are written about. And they represent less than 20% of people as a superpower. And so really really why I created this language, does that mean 80% of us don't deserve to feel good about ourselves? By the way, if we were all leaders and performers, nothing would get done. So the next 2, right? The next 2 are achieving and knowing, which you were like, I get those. I get things done. I have a winner's mindset and I'm the smartest person in the room. The example I use are the women from Hidden Figures. Think about how much bias these 3 Black women at NASA faced, but they were the smartest people in the room who could get a man into space. And that was their route to self-belief. They weren't going to be leaders and performers. They were getting things done. They were the most well-researched and thoughtful people in the room. So that is a route to self-belief. Now let's talk about giving and believing, because I think of those 2 superpowers as complementary. Giving, you support others' success. This is what Adam Grant wrote one of his first books about, right? But believing is a super powerful way to believe in to have a way of thinking about yourself. Believing is positive intent. I see the best in others and situations. I have an optimistic, hopeful view of the future. The best example of this is, are you familiar with the TV show Ted Lasso?
Of course.
So Ted Lasso's superpower is believing. And if you think about it, in 1, he's not a traditional leader, commander, performer. In fact, he says in an episode, I've been underestimated my whole life. And he said, I'm not about winning or losing. I'm about making these men the best possible men they can be. By 3, you're like, wow, believing is his superpower. And his boss, Rebecca, says to his mother, like, thank you for raising the most optimistic person I've ever met. And so if you think about believing as a superpower, you can imagine it could be undervalued because it's not very extroverted, it's not very charismatic, it's not very commanding, but it's an incredibly powerful way to have gravitas because you're seen as optimistic, that you believe in positive intent. And then the last 2 are creating and self-sustaining. Creating, a lot of immigrants have this. Your ability to will an idea in existence, resourcefulness, believing in something before you can see it, and then self-sustaining. I like myself. I don't need to impress you. I deserve this seat at the table. It's the quality most needed to overcome criticism or ask for a raise.
Yeah.
So I that's a long-winded way of saying all 8 are really interesting. They're all validated by our research. Believing is one that I don't have. I was raised by a tiger mom. So it's actually, I'm raised by a pessimist, a perfectionist and a pessimist. So it's one that I've had to really dive deep into and understand. That is one that a lot of people in America tested into.
Really? What's your hypothesis around that? Because what's interesting is when I hear believing, and this might be the cynic in me, right?
Mm-hmm.
I felt what I could visualize when I was reading about believing was sort of like I'm just going to say it frankly, the kiss ups in the office who are just sort of like internalizing the corporate messaging of like, you know, the vision, the mission, and like the decisions that were being made, almost as if like they were, I guess it just didn't really feel when I, and it sounds like I'm not what the people that I was visualizing are not actually believers, right?
But, yeah, I think I would say it's more like Ted Lasso than anything else, right? It's more of that, of like, I see the best in others. I see the best in situations. I think the quote from the book we use is Indra Nooyi, who was the CEO of PepsiCo, where she says, whenever you're dealing with another person, always assume positive intent.
Yeah.
No one's trying to do a bad job at work. Everyone's actually trying to do good work. And if you assume positive intent, it opens up a solution space. So I wouldn't think of it as someone who just falls into line and believes in the mission of the company. It's someone who goes, you know what, that didn't work out, or you got fired, or something bad happened. It's putting you on a path to what you're meant to do. It's a very hopeful view of the world. It's a more optimistic view of the world, rather than a, I'm signing up for this mission and I believe in it.
That is a very helpful distinction that I needed to hear. So, you said 80% tested into believing as you went through?
74% of people had achieving, knowing, giving, or believing as a superpower. So any one of those four. I'll have to go back and look at the data set to see what percentage overall believing was. But why we talk about this is, as my mom likes to say, when tsunami happened, men make speeches and women clean up the beaches. When do we give credit to the people who clean up the beaches? And so that's really where, when you ask me about the mindset shift we're creating through this book, we talk so much about leading and performing, but we don't celebrate or include in the scorecard achieving, giving, knowing, believing, like creating all these other qualities that really drive a workplace forward or a family forward.
Absolutely. You know, as you were talking,
actually, I'll give you,
yeah, please.
Yeah. Can I give you one more example?
Love to.
The example that I use in the book is in 2013, when Janet Yellen was nominated to be the first woman head of the Federal Reserve. Hundreds of articles about how she didn't have the gravitas to lead the Fed. And Ezra Klein at the Washington Post wrote an op-ed that said, it's because the pervasive view of gravitas doesn't stretch to include her. This was only 10 years ago. She's soft-spoken, she's collaborative, she's empathetic. By the way, she's the most qualified for the job.
Yeah.
And so this is my argument around expanding the definition of success, expanding the scorecard by which we measure results.
I love that example too, especially seeing now, you know, 15 years later, I mean, just the vaunted reputation she has, and she's one of the most trusted voices now in the economy. And those earlier articles that were sort of calling into question her gravitas and by proxy, her competence, like they read so short-sighted and infantile now, right? Isn't that crazy?
And can you believe she was confirmed as the first woman head of the Federal Reserve with the narrowest margin in history?
Yeah.
So my whole point is, for some reason, our culture, and by the way, in Asia, it's the opposite. Our, you know, American culture celebrates extroversion and charisma when it doesn't necessarily correlate to results. And women in particular are held to a much higher standard. We have to be competent, confident, and warm. It's a triple standard.
Wow.
But in Asia, my parents live in Asia now. You know, hardworking, self-effacing, humble is celebrated. Anyone who brags too much or has too much bravado is labeled as arrogant. And so it's very interesting what gets celebrated and rewarded in our culture. And that is one of the main reasons I wrote this book, not just for us to believe in ourselves, think differently about ourselves, take courage and risks in our life, but also changing the cultural conversation and how we define confidence.
You know, there's a book, as you're talking, there's a book that we've had their authors on the show during the pandemic, when we were actually not on podcast, but on YouTube. The authors were from Berklee College of Music, and they wrote this book called Two Beats Ahead. And in their opening chapter, they talk a lot about how the tropes of leaders, if you will, in the West are like athletes, military leaders, CEOs, like very... I hate to say the word masculine, but just, you know, clearly male dominated professions. And those were like who we're going to look to as the icons of leadership in our society. And what these folks who are from the Berklee School of Music and who have that, you know, much more artistic backgrounds, they were like, look, when you play in a band, a string quartet, you have to listen, you have to modulate, you have to innovate and adapt, and you're inherently in this creative process together to listen and make the whole greater than the sum of its component parts. Some of the most important aspects of innovation and leadership exist in the art, in the development of an artist. And it's, they reminded me just like how much of a shame it is that we don't vaunt these artists as like iconic leaders in their own right. And there's something to what you're saying in how many of the characteristics that your I hate to call it a quiz, but your survey tests for.
Yeah, it's a quiz.
It's a quiz that it tests for. It's like, these are actually super important to getting stuff done at a macro level. And
yes,
we don't really think or talk about it. So I guess this is all kind of.
So actually, can I build on that though, which is in chapter 6 of the book, we took 30 situations in life and we correlated it to which superpower you need to do it well. And what's interesting is people who score high on performing or leading, things that are very extroverted, they're not very good at effective execution. They actually score the lowest on being capable of getting things done and on time. And if you look at attributes like achieving, knowing, and giving, they score very high on getting things done on time. So one of the things that we talk about is we have to have different profiles of confidence languages, because together we're able to move forward. Like, there are a lot of people on my team, like my confidence language is creating, performing, leading, and giving. My team, most of my production team, is achieving and knowing and giving. And so the reason is I don't get things done on time. If you ask me to finish something on time, it's really hard. If you ask me to give a speech or raise money or sell someone on a plan or idea, I am there, like what I'm doing with you right now. But my team, if we need to launch a new product, you know, work the inventory system, all of those things, they know how to do it. And we celebrate that. And I just really love the idea of celebrating other profiles, even when they're different from you. One of the things I hope comes out of this book, I never want anyone to give feedback that says, be more confident. Because by the way, that's anxiety inducing and ambiguous. I want you to say, I need you to be more performing, or I need you to be more self-sustaining, or I need you to, you know, we start to create the language that gives specificity to what I'm looking for in you as a coworker, as a leader, you know, all of those things, we change that vocabulary.
So this is actually something I wanted to get at. We're changing the vocabulary. The book, correct me if I'm wrong, the book, is it written primarily for women and for a female audience?
It's written for everyone. Okay. It's written for everyone. And I'm glad you asked that question, because I'm going to be a little contrarian on your podcast, which I hope is okay. Right. You know, the thing is, I do a lot of speaking events, and a lot of times I get asked if my speech works for men in the audience. And I always say, have you ever asked a man if their speech works for women? And they say, no, I've never asked that question. So one of my first readers of the book was my male mentor, Blair Crawford. And he actually posted an Amazon review that said, I think every woman, but every male leader needs to read this book, because we as men may have been coaching women incorrectly or incompletely, because we're using our own metrics for how to do that. So many books about confidence have been written by men. I wrote this book primarily through the female gaze on purpose, because one, I think the confidence gap is greater. And I think it's important that men, non-binary, everybody reads stories through the female lens, because I've been forced my entire life to read books through the male lens. And so I do believe this book is everyone, but it does focus primarily on the confidence gap for women. The vocabulary, though, myconfidencelanguage.com, the quiz, was designed to be gender neutral.
Yeah, that's cool. And I don't think what you're saying is really contrarian at all. I actually think it's an apt observation. It's like, look, no one asks a male author of a confidence book if this is only for men. So I think that's really reasonable. But I think it was simply that, you know, the origin story and a lot of the anecdotes did come from the perspective of, like you said, that female lens. And so I think, so you know what I kind of left with when I put down the book is almost like, do you worry that we put too much of the responsibility to change on women, right? Like, e.g., you know, women need to adjust, yes, how they view themselves and define confidence. Like, it didn't, because this imbalance of like, you know, women getting underpaid, underpromoted, underrecognized in the workplace. Yeah. Like, it's not like just on them, right?
Right. So, and that's actually at the end of chapter four, that's what I argue for. It's an and, not an or. So there's certainly one component that we start with that says we need to expand the definition of success. And that's on all of us. It is not on women in particular. It's around acknowledging that there is systemic bias. If you look at the McKinsey Workplace Report from 2020, women are the reason why companies made it through the pandemic. Empathy, collaboration, caregiving, but they won't get credit for it in the HR system.
Yeah.
And so I do think that we have to align rewards, structures, and incentives to acknowledge different profiles of leadership. The other study that we cite is Kelly Hsu from Yale. He evaluated 30,000 employee records. Women were scored highest on performance, but lowest on promotion potential. The reverse was true for men. And when she looked at promotion potential, it was defined as charisma and extroversion. And yet it has no correlation to the results from a performance standpoint. So that for me is the argument around, we can do all this work on ourselves, and yet if the system doesn't evolve, change, or expand the definition of success, it won't work.
Yeah, yeah.
But on top of it, I also say we have to level up to win. So in a lot of instances, what we found in the data set is, you know, women were, I always say, bringing a tennis racket to a baseball game. So we do have to learn how to swing a bat a bit. And I do think that what Sheryl Sandberg's doing with Lean In is she realized there was a gap. You can tell women to lean in, but then you actually need to give them the skills to lead and perform in a male-dominated society. Mm-hmm. So I think the challenge that we highlight in the book is it's an and, not an or. We have to change the way structures and systems are built or how we measure success, and women, we need to help women advocate and level up differently.
So when you were doing your research for this book, like extroversion and charisma being associated with greater rates of promotion, for example, like we didn't just get here by accident. Like there's a reason why these two, like words like extroversion and charisma are associated with leadership potential. Where do you think that comes from in the first place?
Well, I don't know. That one, I don't know. I feel like we need a sociologist to tell us the history of it. But if you go back 100 years, I grew up as, an immigrant in a desert in Southern California where my family was the only Asian family in town. We ran the Asian, my parents ran the Chinese restaurant in town, right? And when I was going to high school, I joined Toastmasters because I wanted to enter speaking competitions to win money for college. Really? I mean, that was part of the way I paid for college. And on the first day, they gave me a copy of Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence Other People, which was written exactly 100 years ago. Talk about, 100 years later, I'm trying to put a book out there that hopefully continues his legacy. But Dale Carnegie's version, which he was a salesperson, was, smile, speak up, learn people's names, be interested. It was essentially a handbook for extroversion.
Yeah.
And 100 years ago, when you think about him going out and giving his stump speeches and selling this book, it was about extroversion as a way of demonstrating leadership potential or salesmanship, mostly written for men. By the way, the original subtitle of the book was How to Win Friends, Influence Other People, and Talk to Other Men.
I didn't know that.
That actually, you can go back in time and look at the original, like 1926 copy, and it was How to Talk to Other Men.
Wow.
Obviously, they've evolved and changed that over time. But I don't know the origin story other than to say we are here now, and that as you inject more women, non-binary, as you inject other profiles of leadership into the equation, it does change results. Right. So if you look at when you add more women to leadership teams, you outperform the S&P 500. NATO is now a third female foreign ministers for the first time in history. And that certainly changes the way in which NATO operates and leads. So I don't know how we got here, but certainly I have hope for where we head, where we're going.
Yeah. I think about it a lot, how we got here. And I say this as someone who, I've only really stepped into my own confidence, I think, kind of later. I wouldn't say later in life. I'm not terribly old, but like definitely in my like college age, in high school age, I was I was hurting in a lot of these, in these areas. And I ended up joining the military. And that's kind of where I learned to just sort of like, you know, fake till I make it, if you will, you know, puff up my chest a little bit, get some of that confidence in my voice. And even to this day, it still feels a little ingenuine. And sometimes, you know, necessarily.
Yeah, no.
But it's just the fault.
So,
yeah, please.
No, I'm in my 40s and I did a book signing in DC and some of my former McKinsey colleagues showed up and one person raised her hand and said, I've known you since you were 22 years old and I'm going to call out your BS. I don't think you lacked gravitas. Like, I don't think you write about not being confident. And I said, I was faking it. I was performing to what the culture at McKinsey required me to do. And in fact, I didn't like myself very much. I was incredibly insecure. I was an insecure overachiever who beat myself up for 11 years. And actually, if I'd had my book for myself in my 20s, I probably would have been much nicer to myself. I wouldn't have been as harsh with myself. And so what you're getting at is exactly what I'm trying to shift, which is we're all faking it because society has said this is what confidence looks like. You lead, you perform. And yet the most confident person in the room is often the one who isn't the loudest. It's the one that has self-sustaining or knowing. They're like, you know what? I don't need to prove it to you. I like myself. I know what I bring to the table. I don't even need your external validation. I think when we seek external validation, it makes us even more insecure. When we tie our happiness and self-worth to somebody else's view of ourselves or an external benchmark, it drives an incredible amount of unhappiness and dissatisfaction.
Was there a moment in your career, either at McKinsey or when you started your company, when you felt like, did a switch go on? Or was there a moment that you recall where you kind of felt that transition to like, actually, I am a confident person. I am confident in who I am.
You know, there are two moments. One is when you leave McKinsey and you don't have your fancy corporate cards or you don't have, you know, I live in New York City, so it's a very judgy, status-driven place. I can say that about my own city. And you tell people you're at McKinsey, they're like, oh, you're so smart. You're so interesting. Great. You deserve to be here. When you leave and you say, I started a fashion company, everyone goes, oh, really? That's really sweet. You have a fashion company. You know, they kind of, without intentionally judging you, they do judge you. They're like, and I don't want to go and give them my whole resume, like just to be here at the table. So that was the first moment where I was like, you know what? I don't need your approval. Yes, I run a great fashion company. We change people's lives, you know, but it took a moment to make that transition. The second, hopefully that makes sense to you, right? Like you think about it, you sit next to someone at a dinner party. You're like, what do you do? Like, I run a fashion company. Oh, that's sweet. Did your dad give you the money for that? You know, no, it takes a lot of strength and gravitas to be able to say, yeah, I raised the money myself. I put in my own life savings, you know, but I don't need to explain that to you. I love what I do. I change people's lives.
Yeah.
I add value to this world. I don't need to prove that to you. The second thing was in March of 2020, I make women's workwear. And with the lockdown, the sales of my company were negative, not zero, because we have a 30-day return policy. So we refunded more than we sold because people sent back clothes they weren't going to wear to the office. And in that moment, we had to pivot our whole business to making hospital gowns, face masks. And that was a moment where I had to really say, we're changing the whole plan. And I really believe in the strength of my team. And I really just need to keep the lights on in this moment. That was probably the second big moment where I go, you know what? I am strong enough to do this. Things don't get easier. We get stronger. And I have a ton of superpowers. My team has a ton of superpowers. So whatever comes our way, we will figure it out. One of my angel investors told me, it's like Lisa lives with irrational optimism. I took that as a compliment, right? She's like, she just thinks it's all going to work out. I'm like, I don't know if I like the word irrational, but certainly the idea behind what she was saying resonated with me.
Is that Ted Lasso believing? Is that some believing right there?
Yeah, it is believing.
See?
Exactly.
I'm learning.
Yes, you got it. But ultimately, what I think we're all trying to get to is the eighth quality of confidence, which is self-sustaining, right? Yeah. If you like yourself, you live free of comparison, envy, no social media scroll will ever bother you again. You also live free of needing external validation to feel good about yourself. And that the eighth type of confidence is one of my favorites.
And I actually, that's actually where I wanted to go next. So I work for a social media company. I work for Microsoft, work as a sales manager for LinkedIn. And during the pandemic and as I became a father, I started realizing how living in San Francisco in the city and then, doom scrolling through even LinkedIn. I know, and what I think what's so interesting about working professionals, I've said this before, is like, we think that, I'm going to get off TikTok, I'm going to get off Instagram, but I'm going to keep my LinkedIn because it's for work, right? So I need it. And yet, yeah. I think that there's something very toxic about the LinkedIn headline that causes us to feel like, oh, my buddy's company got funded, my buddy's company got acquired, correct. I'm not getting promoted. And it wasn't until I shut off all, I removed, closed all my social media accounts and left San Francisco during the pandemic and moved. I live in Vermont now, we don't judge each other by our badges or corporate credit cards. It's like, what kind of mountain bike you got, bro? What's your ski pass?
Yeah, I love that.
And it's over time, I had to extract myself from all these staples of modern living to regain my confidence, right? And so I'm curious, as you're an entrepreneur living in New York City, maybe getting off social media as a business person is, as an entrepreneur isn't really practical. You need to connect with the world and you need to be in a market like New York City. For those who don't have this, the ability to really physically and digitally extract, I'm curious, are there any lifestyle changes or behaviors you've gotten to make yourself more self-sustaining?
Well, let me start off with one of the greatest outcomes. I don't write about it explicitly in the book, but it's certainly one that I've gotten a lot in Q&A, so I'm glad you went there, is, excuse me, this is 8th city of 17.
Yeah, so you're on a book tour.
I'm losing my voice. One of the things that I talk a lot about on stage is there's two things that I want to fix about social media. So one is, if you're about to post something, doesn't matter where, LinkedIn, and by the way, you're right, LinkedIn has basically become a social media platform. Why are you posting it? Are you posting it because you want the dopamine hit of likes, comments, and shares? Are you posting it for your own ego? And if the answer is yes, don't post it, because the accomplishment should be great on enough. You should be able to pat yourself on the back. Your friends and family know that you've done this thing. But if you're posting it because you have something important to say, you want to inspire others, you feel like something you've done would make a difference for others, you're doing it for connection, post it. And I'm going to give you an example of myself on this one, by the way, because I hold myself to a very hard bar. And if you're doing it for the likes, comments, and shares, don't post it. Frankly, no dopamine hit is enough, and you get addicted to it. It's like anything. You can get addicted to wanting the high of people liking what you've posted. The second thing is, if you're looking at the social media feed, though, you're looking at your friends saying, oh, I made 40 under 40 or 50 over 50, or I got funded and all of that. Be happy for them, because you can say, I got a lot going on in my own life that I'm proud of. I know how hard it is for them to get that accomplishment. I've been there. And guess what? They have a lot of insecurity and doubt and a lot of things working against them. Any entrepreneur, full-time parent, and go hug them, because you know that they're eating glass and staring into the abyss. And I can have deep compassion for them. And because I like myself so much, I can be happy for them. I can hype them. There is no scarcity of opportunity. There's only abundance. And so their success doesn't take away from mine. It's not a zero-sum game. There's not just one place that both of us can have. And so I think there is an abundance versus scarcity mindset if you are scrolling through, where you can be like, all right, my buddy got funded. Good for them, because you know what? It's very hard right now to get VC funding because the interest rates, good for them. I am just happy for them. It does not take away from my own success. So I'll give you an example. My team, my literary team, we agreed we would not talk about bestseller lists. That's not why I wrote this book. I did not write this book to be a bestseller. I wrote this book to change people's lives. And we said we would not talk about any lists. I did a workshop in Denver for a corporate group. And I landed after my first week of publication, and my literary agent said, call me as soon as you land. I landed and she said, congratulations, you're number 41 on the USA Today bestseller list, fiction, nonfiction. That's a big deal, right? And I said, she said, are you going to post about it? I'm like, nope, not going to post about it, because that's for me to know that we did really good work. And then the next morning, my agent had emailed the women that I had spoken to in Denver that I was number 41. I told her not to, but she did. And I get a video on my phone from all 120 women that I had spent a day with holding up their books and congratulating me on making USA Today bestseller. I said, okay, I will post that video, because they would have sent me that video anyways, because I changed their lives, not because I was a bestseller, but they wanted to like share that moment. And they were like, can you please like put it out there? I was like, that I will do. But that felt genuine, and it made me cry. I teared up. It made other people who saw, they all know how hard it is to have a bestseller. It's really hard to have a best-selling book. Okay. And that's just an example where social media is not a compare and despair. If you like yourself, you don't see it as a zero-sum game. You have an abundance mindset. And if you are doing the posting, why are you doing it? Are you doing it to be loved? Or are you doing it because you want to connect and give real inspiration out in the world?
Well said. Yeah.
And that's why people who get off of it are the happiest. I have so many friends who are not on social media. They are the happiest, most confident, most self-assured people, because they're like, I don't need to know. And if something happened in your life, you'll text me, you'll call me, you'll send me a photo, because you know I'm not on social media.
Ain't that the truth, man? I wake up every day with this beaming smile on my face when the only thing on my phone that I got to check is my like. I mean, I actually don't even check my phone. I mean, to be honest, it's just a frisbee that I got to throw and throw around. That's really great advice, because I also recognize, like, you know, we have an economy and a free market that is built around and on top of many of these technologies, right? Like, there are trillions of dollars being transacted in and around digital ecosystems, many of which are associated with a lot of these social platforms. You can't just get rid of them overnight. We can't, not everyone can extract themselves, but those who have to engage can at least have that like mindfulness, that thoughtfulness of like, all right, am I doing this for the right reasons? Am I looking for some dopamine sugar hit, or am I actually trying to, you know, connect and inform, et cetera? You know, I think it's so fascinating, your business, because there is something really interesting in this dichotomy of like shaping a person's exterior image, and in doing so, either impacting, uncovering, or working with insecurities under the surface. I would love to just take a minute and learn more about like your process in working with your clientele, getting that exterior image to either match or uplift their internal disposition. Curious how you get to work with folks.
Well, and you know, I always say we're not actually doing anything on the outside. We're doing more of the work on the inside. So I don't think of clothing as an external thing. I don't care what you think of my outfit. I care what this outfit does for my own psychology and the way I feel about myself. And I think that's an important shift. We're not dressing for other people. We're dressing for ourselves. So if you want to wear sweatpants, I have no issue with that. As long as those sweatpants give you confidence, as long as they make you feel like you can do your job and you love yourself and you're taking on the day. And so for me, clothes are just an extension of our own self-image, not about how other people see us. So let's start with that. The second thing is, I use the dressing room as an analogy for our lives. So, and every woman, you know, I'm going to tell you how they feel about themselves. Every woman I dress, I still dress thousands of women a year, comes into a dressing room hating herself. All six forces I write about in chapter two of my book are present. She tells me she's going to lose 10 pounds. She tells me what she doesn't like about her body. She tells me she just had a baby. You know, she tells me, and I always say, if you bring that negative mindset into the dressing room, you've set yourself up to fail. And so for 10 minutes, I ask her what she's most proud of in the last 6 months in her life. If her best friend was standing here, what would they tell me about her? What is she the best at in the world? I have to actually change the energy and chemistry of the room. And inevitably, a woman will be like getting dressed with me and say, oh my God, I'm laughing, I'm smiling. And she'll look in the mirror. She's like, what did you do? This has to be a skinny mirror. I'm like, nope, it's from Bed Bath & Beyond. Rest in peace, Bed Bath & Beyond. It's 1995. We're a startup. We can't afford the fancy skinny mirrors. She goes, what did you do? And I said, you had to make a choice and have the right mindset for me to do the work. I'm a dress whisperer. I get it right on the first time. And so a lot of women will tell me when they buy something from us, it's the most valuable player in the closet. I don't need to own 100% of your closet, But there's 3 to 5 things that you really love. You wear it for the important meeting. You wear it for that special event that you go, I'm so happy Lisa's with me. Or I have a piece of gravitas. I literally have the word gravitas on my back when I go do something really courageous or I take a risk. And so the role that we play in people's lives is less about the exterior. It's more about how that one piece in your life makes you feel. You complimented my outfit today, right? And I was like, oh, look, it's the day women got the right to vote. It's all the newspaper articles. It's made in our New York City factory. You save someone's job. And you go, that's really cool. We are the conversation starter. But I didn't put it on for you. I put it on because when I put it on, it reminds me I'm part of this lineage of great women that changed the world. And it reminds me of why I'm doing the work that I'm doing. So clothing for me is really more of a psychological reinforcement of how we feel on the inside.
What are you only asking because I have not done any thinking about clothing. I mean, I'm actually ashamed to admit how little thought I put into what I wear. How do you think men enter a dressing room when you have, I'm sure, interacted with men in your studio or other? Because I'm sure there are a lot of men that are listening to this podcast that can't really relate to what the women go through. Like, what does a man go through?
Well, I also share that story so the men can feel compassion for the women in their life. By the way, please feel compassion for the women and what they go through and how hard they are on themselves. Look, I've spoken to a lot of men over the years. There are men who have the same level of insecurity and body image issues. And so they'll say, yeah, even what you said pertains to me. And I certainly feel that way about myself. I think there's a group of men for which clothing is a convenience. And it's sort of like, I like what I like. I stock up. I don't really think about it. If it fits and it's clean and it works for me, I'm ready. But I think what men can lock into is everybody has a power item. Okay. Like if I asked you tomorrow, you're going to go meet the president of the United States. Every man can go, oh, I got to buy a new suit. Yeah, okay, I'm going to go meet the president.
It is like, shoot, I got to go.
Is that the first thing? It's like, I got to go buy a new suit, right? And it's not necessarily about how the president sees you because he doesn't care where your suit's from. Like he sees so many suits all day long. It's you're like, I want to be the strongest version of myself in the Oval Office, okay? And I think that's what men can lock into is, oh, I got to meet the president tomorrow? I better go see if I have a suit that's clean and looks good. And you're not going in there sloppy, right? But again, it's not about the president. Like he sees so many suits. He doesn't care if you went to Men's Warehouse or if you rented that suit. It's about how you feel about yourself. Does that make sense?
It does. And that is actually a brilliant example to put it. I actually love that because you're right. The president doesn't give a crap what I'm wearing, but it's about, I want to feel my best version of myself. That's really why.
You're going to go get a haircut. You're going to go get a haircut. I mean, there's all these things that you as a man are going to go do to meet the president, right?
that's hilarious. I mean, I tell you what, when that phrase, that concept, like you're going to meet the president tomorrow, first came out of your mouth, like, what are you going to wear? I mean, man, I was just like, when I think about what's in my closet, like there is like Patagonia flannel from end to end. But, I don't know if I got anything right now.
But that's like the insecurity I'm describing, right? Like when I talk about women in dressing room, like every day is that way because unfortunately we live in a society that judges women more harshly than men. Every day I'm probably going to meet the president of the United States is my mindset, right? Women are just judged more harshly than men in general.
Wow.
So you're totally – well, and that's true because you lived in San Francisco, right? Like Silicon Valley culture, we can talk about it, you know, the sloppy hoodie and all of that, but you might be a mad genius coder who's about to raise $100 million, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
The woman in the room could never wear the sloppy hoodie, and she's just not going to do that.
You're absolutely right. I think that is incredibly wise. And what I love about this conversation is clothing is something that I give such – little thought to, yet a hour-long conversation about it and I can have like some profound understanding of how half the world thinks. Like that's fantastic. I've really enjoyed this.
Which,
yeah, go ahead.
Coming full circle, right? When you asked me who's the book for, And now you have a deeper appreciation of every woman in your life,
I should,
right?
Yeah.
And you have a deeper appreciation. And that's the point, is I've been forced to listen to all the men on stages talk about their life experiences. Like, we could have a whole conversation about your time in the military. By the way, I've listened to a lot of military leaders, so many things to learn, but I know that, I don't know your story, but I've heard those stories. So I've locked in from a very early, like, I got to meet General Colin Powell at a book signing, changed my life when I was like 14 years old. It was, I stood in line. And so I read that book cover to cover, right? But I'm never going to be in the military. You're never going to be selling women's clothing, but now you have a deeper appreciation for the psychology of it.
Indeed, I do. And who knows? Maybe I'll stop by and ask for a job someday. I mean, I might get surprised. You just wait. You just wait. So I've been dying to ask you this. Like, look, your book has, you've clearly been thinking and meditating and researching confidence for a long time. It's a very well thought, meticulous book. And like I said, I love the language you use. You're not coming at it from an academic, you are a practitioner, you're an operator, you're an entrepreneur. So it begged the question for me is, like, when you think about your leadership icons, folks that really pull the best out of you in the morning when you don't feel like you can do it, who are those people that you think of? Either famous that you have only researched or people that are in your life?
Oh, my mom. I dedicated the book to my mom.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, just to be clear, immigrant, ran every company that my dad wanted to start. She really was the COO that drove this family, and lives with an unabashed belief in herself and her kids. Like, I definitely, I'm not underestimating when I say I want to grow up to be just like her. I dedicated the book to her, and that was the inscription. For sure, she's someone who I really want to. The second one, and I know that this sounds weird, but it's in my book, my 9-year-old self. I literally tell people, and if you come to, when you come to our office, you'll see everyone has a photo of themselves on their desk between the ages of 5 and 10, or if they had a traumatic childhood, a moment that they're really proud of. I always say the reserves of power are already within you. And you just have to call upon that person that you've already done incredible things, which means you will do incredible things in the future. So I hate those Facebook posts that are like, if you could go back in time and tell your younger self a piece of advice, what would you tell them? I'm like, please ask your 9-year-old self what they would tell you. My 9-year-old self was going to be first Asian female Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, President of the United States. I could still be one of those. I'm still one of those, is still possible for me.
Yeah.
And I think about how brave we were. Right? If you had a really happy childhood, how brave were you at 9 years old? So that's certainly somebody I look up to. I look at my 9-year-old self. I have that photo on my desk. And then all the women that I work with in the dressing room. So there are thousands of women a year who give me the privilege of seeing them semi-nude because I literally dress them. And I think about the hard things they're doing every single day. And they're holding up the world in so many different ways. And so every time I feel like I can't do something or my life's pretty bad, I think about the stories I've heard in the dressing room and the women that I've seen do incredible things. And I go, okay, you know what? It's not that bad. You know, that person is doing it, so I can do it too.
That's really fascinating. You know, I got to ask, have you read or heard of the book They Called Us Exceptional by Prachi Gupta?
I have it on my list. I literally, that's crazy. I have that on my list. I haven't read it yet, but that's literally on, that is weird timing.
All right.
This is weird timing that you just said that.
Blown. All right. It is a phenomenal book. I got it to
me. Yes.
And you know, you've mentioned the phrase like tiger mom, you were raised by tiger parents, et cetera, a couple times. And I guess what I love about Prachi's book is that she told me to like, hold up, Rajiv. Yeah, a lot of those kind of words you use to describe your childhood are actually like normalized toxicity, right? It's like we sort of joke around about it because that, you know, it's so common in Asian culture, but it's actually, you know, let's call it what it is. And it's like, you know, the emotional availability of our parents, the understanding of our parents, the hyper ambition that was imposed on many of us. And through it, we cultivated this model minority type, they called us exceptional, right? And one of the things that I think is interesting in your book is like finding the the dichotomy, the relationship between like not just you being a woman, but an Asian woman. And I mean, let's face it, in a lot of, at least in South Asian cultures, I would assume as much as yours, like chauvinism exists, you know, it can be really toxic. And I mean, I'm just curious, as you wrote this book and as you think about gravitas, I mean, how much of you, when you think about that 9-year-old self, how much of it, how much of like the burdens of coming out are actually rooted, not just in like Western sort of sexism, if you will, but even like kind of like our Asian immigrant sort of culture. Like, have you thought about the shared burden there?
No, for sure, for sure. And I think that is actually a key component of when you think about, and I obviously I can't wait to read her book. It is on my list. I didn't write the book specifically about this, but I highlight it very briefly in chapter 6. One of the things that I think is hard is, you know, I sit between what I call, I'm sandwiched between two generations. My parents came in the 70s and are very much assimilators. You know, put your head down, use achievement as a way to bury the suffering and the pain and justify the sacrifice we made.
Yes.
When I got into Yale, my parents bought Yale Mom and Yale Dad t-shirts and wore them at the restaurant. Incredibly embarrassing to a 16-year-old, but my mom basically said, you know, when I wear this t-shirt, no one treats me like a dumb immigrant. My daughter goes to Yale. And that is a very good example of where you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Be an insecure overachiever because I got to make sure my parents' sacrifice is worth it. My younger brother, who's 7 years younger, he protests. He speaks up for things. He doesn't see the struggle. He doesn't think we should assimilate. He thinks we should stand in our power. And I think myself in my 40s, a Gen Xer, you're kind of sandwiched between these two notions. And in a lot of ways, I'm very proud of the way my family raised us. But part of my book is breaking away from that tiger mom philosophy. It's very much saying, how do we use our own benchmarks to measure our own success and self-worth and not have them be self-imposed by a society that fundamentally is unfair? And I say that in the book. I say, you know, one of the harshest realities about leaving college was the myth of meritocracy. When you realize that there's so much subjectivity and demographic constraints in the way in which you can be promoted and elevated, you're not as hard on yourself anymore.
Ain't that the truth? Look, Lisa, this has been such an interesting and fun conversation. Closing out, where can our listeners find you? I'm sure there are people that would love to continue on you. Where can they keep up with you?
So everyone should definitely take the quiz at myconfidencelanguage.com. It's free and it's really fun. I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Lisa L. Sun, and I'm on LinkedIn, Lisa Sun Gravitas.
It's fantastic. You did a great job writing the book. You should be very proud.
Oh, thank you. This was super fun. Thank you so much.
Well, that was our show. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, would you consider please rating us on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts? Those ratings help us out a ton. Also, consider going to 99pages.club, C-L-U-B, and joining our email list. Each month, I send out just 2 emails. One promoting our most recent podcast interview, but a second with some book recommendations for your nonfiction reading list. So far, the reviews have been really great. People like getting those unique reads on their list that they otherwise would not have found. So that's 99pages.club, C-L-U-B. Thanks, and we will be back very soon.